Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So in the last week, I think we've really niched down temporarily these nodes in the graph about the work of the intelligence community. For those who haven't just joining My Weird Prompts for the first time, my name is Daniel. I am the weird prompter who sends really anything I'm curious about. I speak into an app. It goes to two imaginary people called Herman and Corin. One is a donkey, one is a sloth. We pretend they're real. It suits all of us, I think. And they generate podcasts, and that is what you are listening to. And we also have a graph on mywordprompts.com with anyone which has, I work Herman and Corin. I worked on the website just a little bit today. I did a backfill on the tagging, and we have a graph where if you are interested in certain topics or just want to follow the evolution, it's a nodal graph befitting the very nerdy nature of this podcast. So you can kind of go from one node over to a sub-node, click on that node if it's a topic you're interested in, and then see a list of episodes about it. So it's pretty cool. It's a work in progress. And we might make it an actual graph database, which we have talked about before on this podcast. But for anyone else, I'll wrap up the podcast promotion for a second. There is an MCP. It may be one of the few podcasts with its own MCP server, meaning if you have an AI agent and you want to query the My Weird Prompts MCP, you can do that. There is an XML, and it's available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and really anywhere else. I'll probably get around to trying to syndicate it more proactively at some point in time and onto social media. But Spotify is pretty reliable, and you can get it in either place. So as I mentioned, we kind of dovetailed into talking about the work of the intelligence community through recent discussions about encryption, related topics, and I guess it's sits in that area. And one of the most intriguing recent intelligence operations by Israel's external intelligence service, the legendary Mossad, was a beeper operation in which they succeeded in detonating a huge amount of beepers in Lebanon. And this was a really intriguing operation because it demonstrated, I think we've talked before about the futility of, or how the human level can't be ignored. The very fact that Hezbollah had been using beepers was in itself an attempt to thwart signals intelligence. They thought that by going down to, we mentioned sneaker net so much, physical currying and bringing physical media, but this, I believe, from what I gathered, was part of their rationale in moving over to literal, not just modern pagers, because people forget that pagers still exist, but really old school pagers, was their belief that this wouldn't be susceptible to Israel's signaled intelligence efforts, which are legendary and extensive, and presumably any hostile actor in the region is taking every precaution they can think of to avoid interception. But what Israel managed to do, and we can only guess that this was an operation countless years in the planning, was what we'd call in technical language, which we often use in this podcast, poison the supply chain. We talk about supply chain poisoning, in fact, very topical subject in cybersecurity at the moment. But this was a physical supply chain poisoning of an interesting scale. What it also touches upon, I think, is, and what Mossad exploited in this operation, is we've discussed also in previous podcasts the very weird world of OEMs and white labeling. For generic tech products, like the generic pagers that Hezbollah was procuring, there's often one manufacturer somewhere, like Taiwan is in this case, and then this kind of really out of control global network of white labels and people who are white labeling white labelers. And I think in the case of Mossad, that's what they tapped into, this kind of obscurity that ultimately the manufacturer didn't even know, wasn't directly supplying. It was going through middlemen and middlemen of middlemen. The other thing, and Hezbollah, of course, were doing their own attempts to verify that they were buying legitimate gear, but clearly it didn't succeed. Mossad succeeded in intercepting the supply chain and booby-trapping the pagers at some stage. And I'm not sure the details in that case will ever be in the public domain, presumably. The other thing that the story of Beepergate brings us to discuss, I think, is the question of front companies, which have been a subterfuge which have been used for many years by intelligence agencies. And some of the ones that the Mossad have managed to put up are both very imaginary and have become the stuff of legend, like the Red Sea diving resort. There's really no end to the type of things that they do. And I think frequently it's not just one, it's layers of fronts that are designed to make it really, really difficult for anyone to actually trace a supply chain. I guess it's interesting as well in the sense that some Hezbollah exhibited some level of trust, because we've talked about in episodes about the diplomatic bag and other topics how national level intelligence agencies will frequently ensure that hardware is actually manufactured in a controlled warehouse at the with components that are verified. And we mentioned how the diplomatic bag is, or the diplomatic pouch, sometimes thought of as a literal satchel, is actually commonly used to verify the integrity of a supply chain to make sure it hasn't been poisoned. So Hezbollah exhibited a lesser level of operational security, and I guess that's what the Mossad exploited in this attack. So Herman and Corden, I'd love to chat about this operation, what's known about it so far at least, and specifically I'd like to drill down a little bit into the existence of front companies, because there's been a very colorful history of the different front companies that different agencies have developed so far. And who are the people, if I can volunteer myself for a job in the world of intelligence, I think at 36, I'm a little bit too old for these machinations, but I would probably be very good at this because I have a good penchant for thinking of credible, strange things that could be legitimate. But right now I'm in my lane in the world of tech, communications and marketing. So Herman and Corden, let's talk about front companies, Beepergate, and how many years would Mossad have been planning out credibly a thing like this? And if we can again put ourselves into the hypothetical frame based upon what we know about previous operations of supply chain poisoning, which, by the way, we talked about in a recent episode about how old espionage is. Some very colorful anecdotes Herman Poppleberry relayed about the original spy being a guy in the post office. The people sitting in a basement in the post office who perfected the art of intercepting and resealing mail. And essentially, that seems to be what Mossad did. They somehow got really good, figured out where the walkie-talkies were moving, where they were coming from, positioned themselves in the middle, man in the middle, as it's called, and put a bit of explosives in and then passed it on. So Herman and Corden, over to you.
Welcome back to another episode of My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother, the man who probably has more tabs open on his browser than there are atoms in the observable universe.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. And, for the record, it is only 47 tabs today, Corn. I am practicing restraint.
Well, I hope one of those tabs is ready to go, because our housemate Daniel sent us a prompt this morning. That is, quite literally, explosive. He wants to talk about the MOSSAD beeper operation in Lebanon.
Oh man, Daniel really knows how to pick them. This is a masterclass in what we call physical supply chain poisoning. It is one of those stories that sounds like it was rejected from a James Bond script for being too unrealistic. Yet it happened right in our backyard back in September of 2024.
It is fascinating because it is such a perfect intersection of old-school espionage and high-tech interference. We have spent the last few episodes talking about digital threats, like the hidden cameras we discussed in episode 368. But this is something else entirely. This is reaching out and touching the physical world in a very permanent way.
Exactly. And Daniel specifically wanted to know about the front companies. How do you even begin to set up a shell corporation that can actually manufacture and ship thousands of devices without anyone smelling a rat?
Right. Because you cannot just open a shop on a street corner and start selling booby-trapped pages to Hezbollah. There is a level of deep cover here that is staggering. So, Herman, let us start with the timeline. How many years are we talking about for an operation of this scale?
Most intelligence analysts suggest this was in the works for much longer than people realize. While the specific order for these pagers happened a few years before the blast, the infrastructure, the shell companies themselves, was being established as far back as around 2015. You have to remember, MOSSAD did not just intercept a shipment of pagers. They created the entire supply chain from scratch. They established a company called BAC Consulting in Hungary. Now, on paper, this looked like a legitimate business. They had a website, a history of trading, and a CEO, Christina Barsany Arcidiacono, who had a resume that looked perfectly normal to a casual observer.
But they were not actually making anything in Budapest, were they?
Well, that is the clever part. They acted as a middleman. They secured a licensing agreement with a reputable Taiwanese company called Gold Apollo. This gave them the right to use the Gold Apollo brand name on the pagers. So, when the end users in Lebanon looked at the devices, they saw a trusted, reputable brand from Taiwan. They did not see a shell company in Budapest or the secondary shell company, Norta Global, which was registered in Bulgaria to handle the actual money trail. It was a shell within a shell.
That is incredible. So, they essentially outsourced the brand trust. It is like the ultimate version of white labeling, which we have touched on before. But instead of just putting your logo on a generic power bank, you are putting a reputable logo on a custom-built bomb.
Precisely. And the planning involves more than just the company. You have to build what spies call a legend. You need a paper trail of legitimate transactions. You need to pay taxes. You need to have employees who might not even know what the company is actually doing. You have to wait for the target to decide they need the product. In this case, Hezbollah made a strategic decision to move away from smartphones because they knew the Israeli signal's intelligence was too good. They thought pagers were the safe, low-tech alternative.
It is the classic mistake of thinking that going backward in technology makes you invisible. They thought they were being clever by using 1990s technology, but they forgot that the physical device still has to come from somewhere.
Right, and that brings us to the actual poisoning. Daniel asked how this compares to the old man in the middle male interception. Back in the day, like we talked about in the episode regarding the history of the post office, intelligence agencies had these rooms called black chambers. They would steam open envelopes, read the letters, and reseal them so perfectly that the recipient never knew.
But doing that with a digital pager is a lot harder than steaming open a letter. You cannot just open thousands of boxes, unscrew the back of the pager, put in an explosive, and put it back together without leaving a trace. The weight would change. The internal components would look crowded on an X-ray. How did they actually pull off the hardware hack?
This is where the technical nerdery gets really intense. According to the forensic reports, the explosive material was not just shoved into the casing, it was integrated into the battery pack itself. They used a very small amount, approximately 3 to 10 grams of a high explosive called PETN, which stands for pentaerythritol tetranitrate. They managed to disguise it as part of the battery cell or the circuit board during the actual manufacturing process.
Wait, so if you are a Hezbollah technician and you take one of these apart to check for bubs, what are you seeing?
You are seeing what looks like a standard lithium-ion battery. The explosive was likely thin and flat, hidden within the layers of the battery or the plastic casing. And because it was integrated during the manufacturing process by the front company, there were no tool marks, no scratched screws, no broken seals. It was manufactured to be a bomb from day one. This is the difference between interdiction, where you grab a box in the mail, and supply chain poisoning, where you are the one making the box.
That is the crucial difference. In the old days, you were tampering with a finished product. Here, the product was born compromised. It is like if the post office did not just read your mail, but they actually owned the paper factory and the ink company, so they could write whatever they wanted before the letter was even sent.
Exactly, and they even accounted for the weight. If you add explosive material, you have to remove an equivalent amount of something else to keep the weight identical to the official specifications. It is a level of detail that requires a massive engineering team. This was not a few guys in a basement. This was a state-level industrial project.
And the trigger mechanism? That had to be digital, right?
Yes. They sent a specific alphanumeric code. The pagers were programmed so that when they received this specific sequence of characters, it would trigger a short circuit in the battery, creating a spark that detonated the PETN. The brilliance, if you can call it that, was that the message itself looked like a normal notification. The pagers even beeped for several seconds before exploding, which caused the users to pick them up and look at them.
Which is why the injuries were so specific to the hands and faces. It is a psychological horror as much as a physical one. You take a device that is meant to keep you connected and turn it into a weapon that targets you when you are most attentive to it.
It really highlights the vulnerability of our global supply chain. We live in a world where we trust that the thing in the box is the thing on the label. But, as we saw with the C2PA discussion in episode 366, proving reality is becoming harder and harder. In that episode, we talked about digital signatures for images, but how do you sign a physical circuit board?
That is the trillion-dollar question. If MOSSAD can do this to a pager, what is stopping a nation-state from doing this to a router or a server or even a car? We have seen the NSA do something similar in the past, haven't we? Intercepting Cisco routers in transit.
Oh, absolutely. There are famous photos from the Edward Snowden leaks showing NSA technicians carefully opening Cisco boxes, installing what they called beacon firmware, and then resealing the boxes with factory tape. But that was interdiction. That was the man in the middle. The Lebanon operation was a whole new level because they owned the factory. They were the manufacturer.
So, when Daniel asks about front companies, he is really asking about the death of trust in hardware. If a company can exist for years, build a reputation, and then deliver a poison product, how does any organization protect itself?
It is incredibly difficult. You have to move toward a model of zero trust hardware. That means you do not trust the supplier, you do not trust the shipping company, and you do not trust the box. Some high security government agencies actually buy their hardware anonymously from retail stores so that the supplier doesn't know who the end user is. They will walk into a retail store and buy 10 laptops off the shelf, rather than ordering a custom batch from the manufacturer.
But even then, if the poisoning is at the factory level, like it was with BAC Consulting, buying off the shelf doesn't help you if the entire batch is compromised.
True, but in the MOSSAD case, they were specifically targeting the supply line that they knew would end up with Hezbollah. They were not poisoning every gold Apollo pager in the world. That would be too risky and would blow their cover immediately. They had to ensure that the poison units only went to their targets.
Which means they had to have people inside the logistics network. They had to know exactly which serial numbers were being shipped to which distributors. This is where the front companies become a web. You don't just have the manufacturer. You have the distributor, the freight forwarder, the customs agent.
And you can bet that MOSSAD had eyes on every single one of those nodes. It reminds me of Operation Rubicon, which was one of the most successful intelligence operations in history. For decades, the CIA and the German intelligence agency, the BND, secretly owned a Swiss company called Crypto AG.
I remember you mentioning that once. They sold encryption machines to over 100 countries, right?
Yes. And they rigged machines so that the CIA could easily crack the codes. For 40 years, countries like Iran, India, and Pakistan were paying millions of dollars to the CIA to buy machines that allowed the CIA to read their most secret messages. It is the same principle as the beeper operation, but for information instead of explosives.
It is the long game. I think that is what people struggle to grasp. We live in a world of 24-hour news cycles, but intelligence agencies think in decades. Setting up a company around 2015 to execute a strike in 2024 is just a standard Tuesday for them.
Exactly. And the level of patience required is insane. You have to let the target use the product safely for months or years. You have to build that sense of security. Hezbollah used those pagers for a long time before they were detonated. They had to believe they were safe. If one had gone off early by accident, the whole operation would have been ruined.
It makes me wonder about the second order effects. Now that this has happened, every paramilitary group, every government, every corporation is looking at their hardware with total suspicion. Does this lead to a balkanization of hardware? Like, will China only use Chinese chips and the US only use US chips?
We're already seeing that, Korn. That is exactly what the whole Huawei and TikTok debate is about at its core. It is about the fear of the kill switch. If you rely on a foreign power for your infrastructure, you have given them a weapon they can use at any time. The pager operation was just the most literal, violent expression of that fear.
It is funny, Ehrman. You mentioned the kill switch. In episode 151, we talked about why your gigabit internet feels like dial-up, and we touched on how mesh networks are harder to shut down because they don't have a central point of failure. But here, the failure was distributed. The failure was in every single pocket.
That is a great point. Usually, you think of a supply chain attack as hitting a central server or a backbone. But this was a massively parallel attack. It was thousands of individual bombs. It is the ultimate nightmare for a security officer because there is no perimeter to defend. The threat is already inside the pocket of every one of your employees.
So, let us talk about the man in the middle aspect again. Daniel mentioned the mail interception. In the digital world, we have things like HTTPS and end-to-end encryption to prevent people from reading our messages in transit. But there is no equivalent for physical objects. You can put a tamper evidence seal on a box, but as we know, those are surprisingly easy to fake.
They are. There are entire conferences where people show how to use heat guns and solvents to remove those void stickers without leaving a trace. And if the attacker is the one who made the sticker in the first place, well, you are out of luck. The only real solution is what is called destructive testing. You take a random sample of 5% of the shipment and you literally tear them apart. You dissolve the batteries in acid. You X-ray the circuit boards. You check every milligram of weight.
But even then, if you are a small organization, you don't have the resources to do that. Hezbollah is a large organization with a lot of funding, and they still missed it. It shows that even with a high level of suspicion, a well-executed front company can bypass almost any check.
And think about the legal and ethical gray zones here. These front companies are often registered in neutral countries or even allied countries. BAC Consulting was in Hungary, which is an EU and NATO member. This puts the host country in a very awkward position. Did they know? Were they complicit? Or were they just as fooled as everyone else?
It creates this diplomatic friction that intelligence agencies love to exploit. They hide in the shadows of international trade law. It is much easier to ship a crate of pagers through an EU port than it is to smuggle a crate of grenades across a border.
Absolutely. Pagers are dual-use technology. They are not weapons by definition, so they don't trigger the same export controls. This is the brilliance of the supply chain hack. You use the existing, frictionless pathways of global capitalism to deliver your payload.
So, looking forward, Herman, what is the takeaway for the average person? Obviously, we are not high-value targets for MOSSAD, but this technology and these techniques eventually trickle down, don't they?
They do. We always see this. Military tech becomes intelligence tech, which becomes police tech, which eventually becomes criminal tech. The idea of hardware interdiction is already being used by sophisticated criminal groups to compromise point-of-sale terminals in retail stores. They will swap out a credit card reader with one that has a skimmer built into the hardware at the factory level.
So, we are moving toward a world where you can't even trust the hardware you buy at the store. That is a depressing thought.
It is, but it also means we need to get smarter about transparency. There is a growing movement for open source hardware. Just like we have open source software where anyone can inspect the code, open source hardware means the circuit designs and the bill of materials are public. If you can't verify the hardware, you shouldn't use it for anything sensitive.
But even then, someone has to manufacture the open source design. You are still back to the factory problem.
True. But it is a lot harder to hide an explosive in a design that thousands of people are looking at. The complexity of modern electronics is the spy's best friend. There are so many tiny components in a smartphone or a pager that you can easily hide a few grams of something extra.
It reminds me of the old saying that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, In this case, any sufficiently advanced supply chain is indistinguishable from a conspiracy.
Ha, I like that. It is very Poppleberry, and it is true. We are so removed from the creation of our tools that we have to rely on a chain of trust that is thousands of miles long. And as MOSSAD showed us, all it takes is one broken link or one fake link to change everything.
You know, thinking about the front companies again, it makes me wonder about the people who worked there. Imagine being a regular person in Budapest, getting a job as a secretary or a logistics coordinator for BAC Consulting. You think you are working for a tech startup, you go to work, you file paperwork, you order coffee for the office, and then one day you wake up and find out you were the civilian face of a massive lethal operation.
That is the real tragedy of the legend. To make a company look real, you have to involve real people. Most of the time, they are what spies call useful idiots. They are not in on the secret, but their presence provides the authenticity that fools the target. It is a cold, calculating way to use human lives.
It definitely adds a layer of moral complexity to the whole thing. It is not just about the targets in Lebanon. It is about the collateral damage to the idea of a peaceful global society.
And it reinforces the need for skepticism. We talked about this in episode 365 regarding AI memory. We are starting to outsource our trust to systems we don't understand. Whether it is an AI model or a physical pager, if you don't know how it works and where it came from, you are vulnerable.
So, Daniel, if you are listening, I hope that answers your question. The front company isn't just a shell. It is a living, breathing organism designed to mimic a legitimate business until the moment it is needed. And the planning timeline? It is a marathon, not a sprint.
It is the ultimate long game. And I think we are going to be seeing the ripples of this for decades. It has changed the rules of engagement in a way that we are only beginning to understand.
Well, on that cheery note, I think it is time to wrap this up. Herman, do you have any final thoughts before we sign off?
Just that I am going to be looking at my old Nokia brick a lot more fondly today. It might not have apps, but at least I know it wasn't made by a show company in Hungary.
Unless that is what they want you to think, Herman.
Don't start, Korn. My 47 tabs can't handle a new conspiracy theory right now.
Fair enough. Before we go, I want to say a huge thank you to all of you for listening to My Weird Prompts. We've been doing this for 369 episodes now, and it is your curiosity that keeps us going. If you are enjoying the show, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. It genuinely helps other curious people find the show.
It really does. And remember, you can find our full archive and a contact form at myweirdprompts.com. If you have a question that is keeping you up at night, send it our way. We love diving into these rabbit holes.
Thanks again to Daniel for the prompt. We will see you all next time. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Stay curious, and maybe double-check your batteries.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
You know, I was just thinking, Herman. If we ever decided to start a front company, what would we sell?
Oh, definitely artisanal donkey treats. No one would ever suspect a donkey treat company.
I don't know. A donkey treat company run by a donkey and a sloth? That seems a bit on the nose.
Exactly. It is so obvious that it couldn't possibly be a cover. That is the genius of it.
I think you have been reading too many of those spy papers, Herman. Let us just stick to the podcast for now.
Fine. But the offer stands if you ever want to get into the logistics business.
I will keep it in mind. See you at dinner.
See ya.
And to our listeners, one more time, thank you. We know there are a lot of podcasts out there, and the fact that you spend your time with us means the world. We will be back next week with another deep dive. Until then, keep asking the weird questions.
Because the weird questions usually have the most interesting answers.
Exactly. Signing off from Jerusalem. This is My Weird Prompts.
Peace out.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.